Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, everybody. Today's episode marks our first episode devoted exclusively to our book club selection for fall of 2023, which is Radical Tarot by Charlie Claire Burgess. And Charlie has been a frequent guest on the podcast. If you somehow have missed their work, which I doubt any of you have, but please go back and listen to some of our previous episodes featuring Charlie, because they are truly an incredible, incredible, generous, thoughtful, and wise thinker and friend. So I know that you will enjoy them. This episode is devoted to a very deep conversation that Angie and I had around the first chapters that we have been reading for the month of October of Radical Tarot, which are the introduction through the chapter on the Hermit. If you're reading along with us, we dive deeply into a lot of the themes that Charlie brings forward in those chapters. But even if you're not reading the book right now, I know that you're going to get a lot out of this conversation. We really used the text as a starting point or as a springboard to go down some really wonderful, winding, deep, deep, deep rabbit holes. To be honest, this is one of, I think, my favorite conversations I've ever released on the podcast. So I know that everyone's going to enjoy it, whether you're reading along with us or not. If you have not yet picked up your copy of Radical Tarot, there is a link in the links in bio on In Search of Tarot on Instagram for $5 off your copy. So head over there, use that link to purchase and get your copy and start reading along with us. And if you are also interested in diving into a deeper conversation around this book with other people who are reading it and with myself, I hope that you'll join us tomorrow night, Monday, October 23rd, for our first Patreon exclusive book club hang. Any patron at any of the tiers beginning at $2 a month can join us for this hang. And I want to let anyone know who's listening on Patreon that's already signed up for that hang. We are going to move the start time of that hang to 7 p.m. Eastern. So it will go 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Eastern. And I'll be sending an email out as a reminder as well. But hopefully that might open up some availability for some other folks who might want to join from other time zones. And to be honest, it's just because of my own hectic, crazy schedule that we had to shift that time. While I'm on that subject, last thing I want to say before I let you hear this conversation with Angie and I is my life has taken a giant acceleration forward in terms of commitments, and I have significantly less time in my life to devote to podcasts and some of my writing and things that unfortunately do not pay. As I've shared before on the podcast, our Patreon goes right back out to pay our guests, which is exactly what I want to happen, but it does not provide any income at all to me. And so unfortunately, because we live in the world we live in, I need to prioritize things that are actually keeping a roof over my head. So yeah, just wanted to kind of give you a heads up that you may notice some changes. You may notice that episodes release on different days of the week and that every single week does not have an episode. So I thank you for being here. I thank those of you who support the show. You really make it possible for it to happen at all. And I really look forward to diving into the book with the book club members. I hope that anyone listening that wants to join us Monday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. Eastern to talk about the book, join us on Patreon as little as $2 a month and support the show and come get nerdy with us and explore these themes and topics. So thank you so much for listening. Enjoy this episode. I know that you will. All right. Hey, Angie.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad to be back with you and excited to do something new with this this book club series. Anybody that is joining us that doesn't know already, although we've been talking about it a lot, we are currently hosting our very first In Search of Tarot book club. We are reading the book Radical Tarot, Queer the Cards, Liberate Your Practice, and Create the Future by Charlie Claire Burgess. And we're making our way through that from October through December of 2023 and reading little chunks of the book each month. And this month we have been reading the introduction through to the chapter on the Hermit. So this is our first time Angie and I are discussing this. We're going to release these discussion episodes towards the end of each month as a free way to kind of connect with the book club. But yeah, Angie, I'm so excited to dive into this with you.
I'm so excited as well. I think that we have been craving this kind of like free form. Let's just discuss the things that stuck out to us. Not that we don't do, you and I do this a lot when we're not recording. And so I think this will be really interesting to kind of meander through the book and talk about the things that spoke to us. And I'm really excited to talk about this with our Patreon tarot hang friends.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what everybody's thinking about this. And we were saying before we hit record, you know, this is the first time we're doing one of these, so we don't know what's going to happen. We'll see. We'll see. We've made a list of things that we want to discuss. We'll discuss them. We'll see what comes up. And then we are going to close out with a few questions to kind of leave for everybody to ponder and kind of engage with as you are reading the book. Also, we would love to hear, you know, your thoughts. You can always email us at isoppod@gmail.com. You can always comment on our stuff on Instagram or DM us and let us know, you know, what you're thinking of the book and what comes up for you as you listen to this episode. So should we dive in?
Absolutely. Let's get into it.
Okay. So the first note that I made for myself anyways, or I guess I should ask, did you have anything that you wanted to discuss from the intro, the introduction section?
No, because we ended up talking about like a lot of the things that I marked in my book were similar to what you put in our notes. And so,
okay.
So we ended up kind of talking about the same things or wanting to talk about the same things, but we wanted to start out with what we kind of touched on this in a little bit in the interview with Charlie, but the thing that spoke to us both on the very first page of the first chapter, so chapter one, and this is on page three, is the meaning of the word radical, which we do a lot of pondering about on this podcast. But did you want to read through that next?
Yeah, I was, I'll quote this section on page three. Charlie writes, radical in the sense of boldly deviating from and questioning the norm, and radical in the sense of the word's lesser known meaning as, quote, of, relating to, or proceeding from the root, end quote. Now, so we talked about this with Charlie on the first episode of this season's, of this season. And I had never heard the word radical defined in that way as being about, you know, rootedness. And that just really opened up a lot for me in terms of, I think, how I feel about mythological reachings that as a white Western person kind of bother me. It bothers me how Greek mythology is so often like pointed to and this sort of like colonial impulse to like go back to the beginning of how things were, or also this very conservative notion, like in Western politics right now, of like make America great again, or kind of like bring times back to how they were. This like very mythological sense of like an original way that things used to be, and that's better. And I really liked this pointing to like that actually the root, like the origin point of things is radical, you know, like is, and we talked about this with Charlie, like is chaos, is marginal, you know? And if we're going to go with Greek mythology, you know, chaos was one of the original, I think, titans, or one of the original sort of deity beings, and was this like void, this like margin space, you know, from which things, you know, came into formation. And in relation to tarot, like I do think about that sometimes in zero, like the fool, you know, sort of the numerology of zero. But I just thought that was so helpful to think about radicalness as being actually rooted to how things used to be. And so like in moments when you're questioning things, when you're pushing beyond definitions, that is the origin. Like the definition, right. The definition isn't the origin. The definition is like our human way of trying to like codify and define, but actually the origin is even deeper and stranger, you know, and more radical than that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think that even the notion, right? Like when we catch ourselves in these moments, like you're pointing to like being a white masculine presenting, I guess, person, mm-hmm. and unpacking all of the things that come with that. And often just the question, how did we get to here? Right? Like wanting to trace back to that root feels so radical. Mm-hmm. And as we say kind of a lot on the podcast of like, just the notion of asking the question is disruptive, right? And so it kind of throws all of these pieces in the air for us to discern what truth is and how did we get to here. And so I don't know how like disorganized and messy and chaotic that can be, but as it says on page 9, where we're talking about chaos and the way that, you know, we're talking about this in the reference, in the way that like tarot doesn't tell the future, but tarot can help us create the future. Like chaos is kind of the catalyst for things that can happen, right? It makes the way for the future. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really, really interesting.
Yeah. Charlie writes on page 9, quote, chaos inserts the necessary uncertainty to allow the improbable and extraordinary to happen. Mm-hmm. That's a great sentence. And, you know, reminds me of like rupture, which is something earlier this year I was kind of obsessed with from a queer standpoint, like the act of rupture as being, you know, a space, like a crack. I just heard this quote yesterday. I think it's bell hooks, I'm pretty sure, who said, notice the crack in the pavement. It's a new world coming. I'm totally butchering that quote. Yeah. But something along those lines, and that, rupture. And it also, there was Quoley Driscoll's book that I read earlier this year that now I'm totally blanking on the title, but I've referenced it in several other episodes, who is a queer two-spirit Native American, was talking about like the ruptures in history, you know, the cracks or the places where history, there's like a gap in history or a lapse in history, mm-hmm. are fertile, you know, ground for queers to kind of write ourselves into the narrative. Mm-hmm. And that's where new worlds, you know, can be born. And I do feel so much possibility and inspiration in that kind of thinking about rupture and gap. And I also always feel like it's important to name that it's very painful to be left out. That it's sort of painful to have to rely on a break or a rupture to find oneself, you know, like yeah. that you're all, you know, like it would be a lot easier if like we were just there, you know, like if yeah. we were just already in the story, you know, but it also leaves a lot of space and, you know, makes me think of the margin, like literally the margin of a book, you know, and the gaps, you know, that are there for you to kind of write yourself in.
Absolutely. I feel this reminds me of something that we say often when people are like in Mormon faith, we have what's called, or like a metaphor, we call things, or put things on the shelf when we don't know what to do with like a gap in our knowledge or our faith or whatever, that we notice an indiscrepancy or like some dissonance. And instead of investigating or getting closer to that, we often say, put it on the shelf for later. Mm-hmm. And then when we actually feel that kind of break in our faith, we call that the moment where the shelf breaks. And nobody wants to be responsible for even like, I would say a lot of people outside of the church don't want to be responsible for someone's shelf breaking because it is incredibly painful. Mm. It's incredibly traumatic. But, you know, on the other side of that, there is this like, you know, for me personally, it's like spending 15 years later saying that I'm like the closest to myself, the closest to what I feel, whatever God is, you know, that the closest I've ever felt to whatever truth is kind of a being able to get intimate through that query. Mm-hmm. Anyway, mm-hmm. I just love like the possibility that lies in chaos. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And getting to understand ourselves better through the tool that the tarot is.
Yeah. I don't know if you'll have any kind of answer to this a question, and that's okay. But something that just kind of came into my mind with that is like, so for me, my sort of barometer for connection to divinity or the margin, or, you know, however you want to name that, is when something just can't be put into words. Like, and you know what's so interesting is that this season, every interview I've had, which I tend to edit this out, so listeners may not know this, but either I or the person I'm interviewing has forgotten what they were saying. And I think that's so interesting. Like, it's interesting to notice that there's like something in the air right now where everybody's forgetting what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because we're overstimulated. There's a lot to process, like, you know, but I also tend to think that sometimes that happens when we really are getting into the thick of it, you know, and and we're sort of thinking, we're realizing there's so much complexity, you know, that we're realizing all these layers, and it becomes just, you can't even speak anymore, because you're just like, well, you know, like, and that's when I think a real sign that you're like at the margin, you know, like, because to me, the truth, quote unquote, of the margin is, you know, unspeakable.
Wow. That's so funny. I call it awe, like A-W-E.
Yes.
That's what I call it.
So my question to you is, what is the place of that in the practice of tarot, you know, or mm-hmm. because when we come to the cards, we tend to be, we're wanting to interpret them, right? So we're wanting to like lay the cards out and receive some kind of message. And what is the balance between interpreting and also leaving space for something that can't be interpreted, or like awe, you know, and mystery, mm-hmm. and like, what do you think about that? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
You know, it's interesting because I think that a lot of times when I'm looking at the cards, there is a component where I go, well, I don't know, this is kind of like my crossroads, if you will, right? Like the, and in magic, when we're talking about crossroads, it is kind of a liminal space that you either create or that you go to for your magical workings, right? I think a lot of times these readings in hindsight make a lot more sense, because at the time that I'm reading or interpreting the cards, I don't have the words for it. And then usually it's in hindsight, say nine or you know, a year later or 9 months later or, you know, years later, I can look back and it makes a lot more sense. But it's like the meeting place of like looking back at it from a future standpoint and trying to reach forward into what will happen. That is that space, and which is not really an answer to your question, but that's kind of what came to me.
No, I love that. I love that. And it reminds me of Lee Clapp from Liminal Sight, who was on the podcast a few seasons ago, had a quote one time that said something like, the future is in the past and the past is in the future, you know, meaning that it's only when once we go into the future that we can look back, you know, into the past, but in the past we were sort of imagining the future, you know, and like that tie of those things. And like, I'm always completely obsessed with time. I've been writing about time on Patreon recently. And it, also time has been coming up a lot, like synchronistically, you know, and a lot of people seem to be kind of pondering that, like, around this turn of the season and fall and sort of the nostalgia of that. But that's interesting to think about in relation to tarot reading and how, you know, a lot of people use tarot for fortune telling or future telling, you know, but how I agree, like, I totally agree that sometimes, well, you know, and it makes sense because like things may come up in the present that we can't see coming. Like we really would have no way of even being able to interpret or imagine what that card is trying to say until later. And then we're like, oh, I see, which is very much like astrology too. I think a lot of times, you know, you really can only interpret a transit. You can really only interpret like a transit in retrospect, you know, when you're like, oh, now I see what Saturn was doing there, or you know, what impact that alignment had, you know, in my life.
Yeah, it feels very like in the spirit of the Fool to me, right? Where you're kind of like neither here nor there. I think about, I don't know why, a lot of times, like in my envisioning of like these cards, it always happens in kind of like a red rocks environment. And so I just had a picture in my mind of like the Grand Canyon. And so if you were in like the Colorado River, right? And you're weaving and you're really like in the weeds, so to speak, you really can't see like the ultimate destination of where you're going. it's not until you kind of elevate your stance and you're able to like see that you're traveling from this point to this point, or the journey looks like this. But you really can't get there until you have kind of a further up perspective. And so it feels very like the Fool to me. Yeah.
Well, maybe we should move forward a little bit. Charlie starts this with this radical tarot manifesto, which I love, kind of like I said, just defining, radical and sort of talking about what tarot, what Charlie feels tarot, can or can't do. And then in chapter two, there is some history of the cards. And something that came up for me as I was reading this chapter when Charlie got to the five elements and the majors and minors and everything is just that, like, the segmentation of aspects of ourself that happens in these systems. And I'm not saying that's wrong, good or bad. It just kind of is what it is. Like, just like astrology, like we were just talking about, just like numerology, tarot, all these things are sort of, using different icons or planets or images to speak to different pieces of ourself, which can be very useful, like in moments where we're confused, or don't know what to do, like it can help to kind of spotlight maybe an aspect of our life or something that's happening, or a piece of our personality or, whatever. And I sometimes wonder about looking at ourselves in this kind of spliced up kind of way. And this also reminds me of, like, in metaphysical teaching, like shadow work or like light and dark, or that binary idea. And just these separations of self where, rather than sort of looking at a really integrated sense of self, and Charlie spoke to this on the interview we did with them, especially I think around the court cards, and talking about how they look at the court cards and just saying, like, really they're very fluid and really there's pieces of them in all of them, and I just think that's really important. I think that can be, I think people can feel, I suppose, understandably, like they need to like understand each individual card first before they can kind of mesh them together. Because I remember when I was a young tarot reader feeling like, well, how is this different than this? Like, how is the, I don't really understand how this card is really that different from this. But sometimes I'm like, well, maybe it's, that's okay. Like, maybe we don't need those definitions. Maybe it can just be more in the moment. Like, I often think a lot of times when I work with tarot, and then I'll be quiet and see what you think, but I often feel like almost all the cards could say all the things,
Oh, yeah.
and I think that that's part of why it works, like, which maybe feels like a cop out or maybe feels less magical, but like I think that's kind of part of why tarot works, is that you can kind of find, you all these images are evocative and can bring forward what naturally just wants to come out anyways.
Well, totally. I think I would argue that it actually makes it maybe more magical, right? It's like, looking at a piece of art, looking at a Jackson Pollock painting and be like, what stands out to you? If you're looking at it with 10 different people, all 10 different people might have a different thing that jumps out at them from the same imagery. And so, I don't know. I think there is something magical in that. And so that's, and kind of what you were saying before, like it's a very understandable thing to want to look at one aspect of yourself and try to understand it as deeply as you can, right? But it's like going to therapy and being like, all right, so to unpack this behavior, you actually need to know this, five things about me from my past and how they all touch these different aspects of, my parents or my school experience or whatever. Like, none of those things are isolated from each other. So I don't know that you really can like separate them truly from each other. But it also like helps us to kind of get a little bit clearer on what it is that we're actually trying to get to know, or obviously this is like the cards, and everybody's kind of collective experience with one image is kind of how we start to distill down into like five keywords or whatever that we associate with one card. But even still, to liberate a card or an image from those five keywords is where possibility is again.
Yeah, you're so right. It does make it more magical. And this kind of speaks to something that I felt for a while. And one of these days I'm going to figure out how I want to kind of teach this or, you know, what I want to do with this. But like for a while now, I've had this feeling of like, I think that when we talk about reading tarot, we should, or like working with tarot, we should look at it like on the, as a whole, like rather than approaching it as like learning each card and like drilling into each card. It's like the entire act, like what are we doing when we work with tarot, and even looking at the deck of the cards as like a one magical thing, you know, like, yeah. And one of my favorite things I ever did, I was teaching just like a super open intro, like one night only kind of for fun class at a local witch shop near where I live. And none of these people had worked with tarot, and I only had an hour and a half. I wasn't about to try to like, So instead, like we really did just kind of draw at random and like put it down in the middle, one card, and then just go around the circle and be like, what do you see? What stands out to you? You know? And there was some consistency, but there was some variation. And like, it's interesting to think of it in that kind of loose, simple, but highly, I think, magical way of like, look at all these things this one card can do. And like the magic is really the relationship between the image and the viewer, you know, and like, and what comes forward for them. It's not, I think sometimes, and I'm not saying this is wrong. I think for some people, there's a sense of like, the animistic quality of the cards, which can still be there, but like this sense of like, you know, for instance, like Three of Swords, like that the card Three of Swords kind of has this message, and it will like find its way to you to like give you that message, you know, versus that the tarot deck, that the magic lies in like the relationship between the user and the whole deck and just like all these images. And really it's the same thing. Like that's kind of the same thing and a little bit different. You know what I mean? Like
right.
those are two very closely tied approaches. But I think what I'm trying to point to is like maybe a little bit less definitive message that each card like constantly carries for like any person that works with it. You
for
know?
Sure. Yeah, no, I do a similar thing when we're doing like collective dream interpretation, like if somebody wants to give their dream out for interpretation to the group, and then each individual person will say like, well, to me this kind of might mean this, and then, you know, collectively we might land on a couple of like agreed upon meanings. But it's like saying, you know, what does a snake mean? I saw a snake in my dream, what does that mean? And it might be, it's highly personal, like what does a snake mean to you? If you have a phobia of snakes, then yeah, certainly that would not be a great sign, but somebody else might actually love snakes. Maybe they raise snakes, you know, so a snake to them will be a, you know, a complete 180 from what that first person said. Right. And so it's like, and interestingly, I feel like a lot of us might even say like, oh, snake means bad. Snake means devil. Well, according to who, which feels very like Hierophant to me, you know, like,
yeah.
Who said? What is the template for this?
Right. Yes, that it leaves a lot more room for like cultural difference and for like lived experience difference. You know, it kind of it really allows it to be personal. Like it allows it to just be, you know, here's this user of the cards that it has their unique, you know, life and existence, and it's about what they are bringing forward to the card, and then what the card pulls, you know, out of them. But it's not, the card doesn't come with the prescribed, you know, message, you know, which has been defined by, you know, as we've talked about on the podcast, like a pretty problematic group of individuals, you know, for the most part.
I think it's okay to say something like, you know, historically this thing has meant this, but it doesn't necessarily mean that this means this now, right? It's like what we talked about on the episode with Charlie about the cutting off the tip of the ham. Like we can change these formats according to what our needs are now.
Yes, that is such a good applicable story for what we're talking about. Yeah, and I do want to be clear, like just for anyone listening, that you know, yes, I am not saying that you should not work with the cards, however, you know, you work with them. Just, this is all just conversation and, you know, things to throw into the mix, you know? So let's see, moving forward. Oh yeah, I do want to just mention that Charlie like so kindly called me out in the text on page 22. And so I'll just read this little section right here. So Charlie says, "We do not have to keep using the masculine feminine duality in tarot just because it's traditional and established. In fact, when the masculine feminine duality is deployed in tarot and in most of the above systems, it's used as a metaphor, like an adult version of the put the square peg in the square hole game for toddlers. Human genitals and heterosexual intercourse are used as a lazy shorthand that roughly translates to two things that are dissimilar but complementary. So instead of so instead of reducing the mysteries of the universe to missionary style, why don't we do as my friend and colleague in non-binary tarot Nick Kepley recommends, say what we actually mean." And so I just want to, you know, attribute and thank Alok Ved Menon, who is definitely who inspired the seed of that, you know, thought for me, along with I have such a vivid memory of the night in 2020 when I'd been listening to Alok a lot and had been exploring my own gender, and then therefore thinking about it in relationship to tarot and feeling very conflicted about that. And just all of a sudden one night it was just like, I'm done with this. And I just like went on my stories and just like, I can't remember what I said, but I just put out like, this is ridiculous. Like, you know, this masculine feminine thing's got to go. And just my phone just like blew up. Like so many people were like, yes, like, oh my gosh, thank you for saying this. Da, da, da. And then that evolved into like several story series that I did kind of like exploring that. And Charlie had told me like, you know, what you did with that was like really like helpful and formative for me. But all that really came from Alok. And so I just want to like really thank Alok Ved Menon for like the germinating of that sequence for me, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I also think this is something we talked about with Charlie on the episode, but you know, the naming of gender and gender's power in the world. This I think comes in a little bit later with the Empress, but we can talk about it now. You know, because this is something I talked about with Saray Jarrell last week too, is like the importance of naming these things and not just kind of acting like they're not there. You know, I think, and I feel guilty of this, you know, myself. I think there's an impulse to, you know, not put any of this gross stuff that we're trying to resist into our tarot practice, you know, or like, I'm trying to get rid of capitalism. I'm trying to get rid of patriarchy. I'm trying to get rid of racism. I don't want to like infuse that, you know, into my practice. I want to use the cards to like imagine something else. And, and I think there's a important balance to strike there of like, well, you know, it is in the world. And so when and how does it actually play in, you know, like I said this with Charlie, like you can't just, I think it's a lot to expect yourself to just act like gender doesn't exist, because it is a real thing in that it is pervasive in our world and we are faced with it like every single day of our lives, you know?
Yeah. I think the compassion piece, I guess individually would be like, it makes a lot of sense to me why someone would need to reject it altogether in order to get that distance away from it, in order to kind of choose, if you want to incorporate that back in, what pieces of that you might take as your own or not, you know what I mean? So to me, it's a very human thing to want to have that distance. But you're right, there is part of it that is like, well, this thing is here and it exists, and so how am I going, you know, what is my relationship to it, how am I going to choose to interact with it? And I think that's the key piece, is choosing what your interaction is with it, and being, in fact, I think that Charlie says it later in a different chapter, but it is like an intentional participation. That's what that is. I can't remember whose phrase it is. It might be bell hooks. I might be incorrect on that. Don't quote me, but an intentional participation in the things that we want to be in relationship to, I guess.
Yeah. And the longer I'm doing tarot, the more I'm realizing that I think this is just kind of, this is the deepening of the practice that occurs in like religion or ballet. Like I'm always in conflict with ballet, you know, in my other life as a dancer and as a ballet teacher, you know, and some of us, I think we get really confronted with these dark night of the soul moments where with our practice, where we're like, oh my God, like this is so problematic. This is so fucked up. Like, I can't keep using this. I'm just going to reject everything. And then a lot of people leave, you know, a lot of people are like, this is not for me. And then some people stay, and then you kind of find your way back again. And then you go through another like dark night of the soul, you know, as I'm saying that, I'm not meaning to like valorize sticking with something that's problematic, because that's obviously not great either, but that there, if you can find your way through it and really, really have a good like inner compass of like, what is truly like cannot be done, or what is there a nugget of like truth to be kind of stuck with in, you know, and like that's what really enriches, I think, the spiritual path, like in general, you know?
Right. I think even having like a relationship with that radical inquiry, you know, having a healthier relationship with that is perhaps like the thing that we can glean initially is like, well, if I can't reject it, then how can I continue to like be okay with this? With this perpetual reforming. Yeah, questioning. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Questions. You know, yesterday I was in this, I'm part of Living Systems with Leah Garza, and on our, what do we use? Not Slack, but on our like chat platform, there were some really difficult topics, you know, that we were wrestling with, and I was asking questions, and someone said, and you know, I'm putting these thoughts out just to voice them. Sometimes I feel like people are trying to like make a point. Mm-hmm. And I felt like in saying that the person was sort of thinking that I was, as I was asking these questions, that I was sort of playing devil's advocate, or that I was like trying to sort of prove my point through the act, through like getting them wrong or like calling them out through these questions. But, and so I said back, like, I really find questions useful in dialogues like this, because they feel like they keep it going. Like, if you're in a conversation where people are just all like, yes, you know, then it's just like, okay, well now we're great. Let's move on. I mean, like, you know, where do you go from there? It's like, you have to keep digging in. And like, that's what I think questions can help do, is like keep bringing you forward, keep pushing you in new directions, you know, and they can bring out differences. Like, you might disagree, yeah, you know, but like, that's that. I just don't know how to have a conversation without like questions, you know?
Well, I mean, and I think the lack of questions is often how we get to these places of like, wait, how did we get to this awful place? You know,
yeah, it's yes,
got complacent. We stopped asking. So anyway,
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
I guess, my love letter to question asking. But yeah, I very much relate.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see what else in the, oh yeah, I was going to mention in the magician chapter, I spent a year, and you were with me in this, with Sarah Hanks, a couple years ago in a tarot study group. And something that, because I think you hadn't joined at the beginning when we were on the magician card, a lot of people in that group brought up charlatanism as connected to the magician, and I think that's really interesting, because historically it does appear that that probably, you know, makes a lot of sense for that card. A lot of those earlier images were like someone was juggling, there was and kind of street jugglers or street magicians would have been a little bit more like tricks, you know, and sort of like asking for money to like do these tricks and whatever. And then through the Golden Dawn's, you know, interpretation, it became more like the esoteric magician and sort of the ceremonial magician, and sort of like changed into that. So I guess like I'm bringing that up because I do just think it's interesting, because that group was a particularly like ex-Mormon group, and so there was a lot of feelings about the charlatanism of Mormonism and like cults, you know, cults.
Yeah.
And I just always think that's interesting when like a very particular lived experience brings out a totally different interpretation of a card, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I read this was a fabulous book. It was called Zealot, and it's a book called by Reza Aslan. And he writes a lot about Christ, and there was something that just woke up something in me. It was so interesting because he was kind of painting a picture of like the historical context and why, you know, what does it mean to say zealot when you're actually calling somebody that, et cetera, et cetera. But he was saying, you know, that Christ was not the only person calling himself a Messiah. In fact, there were many times, many people who were traveling around performing miracles, much like a kind of snake oil salesman might do, like, take my little tonic and then this miracle will happen and you can thank me, you know. And so there were many people professing to be the Messiah. There were many people performing these miracles. And who's to say whether they were actually miracles or whatever they were? And to some people, they were miraculous. They were, you know, they took it as an act of God, and other people were maybe calling them charlatans. And part of that is the confusion on who we understand Christ to be, right? And I feel like that's very much tied in with a lot of how ex-Mormons view Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith did participate in things like scrying or using dowsing rods or using other various tools. Like, he was a mystic, but that didn't mean that he didn't create an enormous wave of harm to all these different people. And so I think that, I mean, back to kind of our using the tools that we have at our disposal to ask those questions and not just believe that the sleight of hand is gospel, is something that we need to, I guess, get comfy with, like, potentially being the disruptor, you know, but it is, it's really hard, because I think that being that person means that you're going to be the kind of outlier, right? It puts you in the position of like a hermit, I guess, almost.
So. Yeah, that's actually interesting to think about that connection, because, and I was going to talk about this, you know, when we get to the hermit, but I really like to think about cards 1 through 9 as like a line rather than 1 through 7, which is like a popular breakup. And that's just because of numerology and stuff I've learned about numerology. And I've never felt like the 3 lines of 7 really worked for me. And then when I started to think about it with 9, I was just felt a more of an affinity for that, you know, breakup of the line. But it's interesting in that way to think about that relationship between how that is presented to itself right from the beginning in card 1, and then how it does maybe come around again in card 9, because something that Saray Jarrell really helped me understand last week is the role of the elder, and how I talked about this with Charlie, like how I really feel sometimes like the questions I ask are interpreted as being disrespectful towards like teachings, towards, you know, quote unquote elders in the tarot world, or, you know, people get really, sometimes really been out of shape about that. And Saray Jarrell was like, just because you're old doesn't mean you're an elder. Like, like an elder is someone that cares about the young people, someone that cares for the young people, that is trying to help, you know, like encourage the young people. And when he said that, I was like, yeah. And for me, like, a caring elder would want a young person to be questioning, you know, like, absolutely. I don't think a true elder would want you to just kind of listen to them like they're a guru on a mountaintop, you know, like they would want you to engage because they would understand that that's how you come into wisdom, you know, is through your own questioning, you know, like, and so that kind of helped me understand why I feel resistance and hesitation around people that are framed as sort of all-knowing and or that frame themselves in that way. And this comes into play, I think, I mean, not to get on a sidetrack tangent, but just like, I really am bothered a lot of times by something I've noticed in the last like couple years in like spiritual space, and honest, particularly to be honest, like white spiritual space, like this like sense of like, I'm just going to be, I just do whatever I do. Like, you know,
oh
like,
yeah.
Like take it or leave it. Like, and this is who I am. And I'm so wild and free and, you know, and like
speaking my truth.
Yes. Yes. Speaking your truth.
How dare you like, interrupt me speaking my truth, Nick.
Right. Right. Yeah. And like, I'm like, that doesn't feel eldery, because that feels so completely disregarding, like other people and like I don't know. I just that just
Yeah,
really, really bothers
factions
me.
don't exist in a vacuum. That's very like toxic sovereignty. You know, like I really understand like the place and what we're trying to give back to people is a sense of autonomy and allowing themselves to choose what is right for them. But then it becomes this kind of like weird, toxic version of sovereignty, which is like more meism.
Yes, honestly, that's very reversed High Priestess. Like, if you're someone that reads with reversals, like I feel like that's super reversed High Priestess, because if High Priestess is about sovereignty, is about kind of that intuitive like knowing, then I think a reversal of that is like rejection of all else in order to maintain sovereignty, you know, like in order like and it and to be honest, like I think it's a little bit it is escapist to me too, because it's privileged, because to be able to really stand on an island like that, you have to have the privilege of being able to be disconnected in that way and to be unaffected by anything else that's happening, you know, like.
It feels very like when you said that the like reverse version of the High Priestess, it made me think of like the way that people view President 45, let me say it like that, on like a pulpit, like to just take every ounce of what every word that comes out of his mouth as gospel, no matter how ridiculous it is. It's so interesting. And then, you know, saying it as if it's truth, you know.
Speaking of the High Priestess, before we move on from that card, I did just want to call out the bit of history that Charlie shares on page 44 and 45, which I did not know about the Visconti family. So Charlie says, it's also known that the Visconti family, who commissioned the first tarot decks, were no fans of the Roman Catholic Church and had a long history of run-ins with papal power. And then a couple lines later, they say, another theory for the Popus's genesis includes a Visconti ancestor, Sister Maifreda Visconti da Pirovano, who became an actual real-life Popus of a French Christian sect. So always loving a little history with the cards, and I did not know that.
I mean, they probably wouldn't like us to know that, would they?
Right.
but I love that. It kind of makes me frustrated because I'm like, oh my gosh, I love this kind of fringe historical figure that we never would have heard of.
And also I always think it's interesting and important to like ponder the history, like the time and place in which the cards were first emerging, you know, and like which there was, it's important also to say that, you know, it did not start there, that it they actually, you know, that the Mamluk decks, you know, and even further back with China and playing cards, and there's a long, long history of playing cards and of the tarot before they reached like white privileged Renaissance society. But then to also think about what happened when they did, and the, you know, the time and place in which they emerged and the very political meanings that they carried, you know, early on.
Interesting because that world feels very different and in some ways not, and not very different from the world in today, but in some ways completely alien.
And this is what I think Ceree Jarrell was pointing to last week too. If anyone's not listened to last week's episode, I really encourage you to, because Ceree Jarrell really goes into like the connection of capitalism and tarot and how and why perhaps they really cannot be taken apart, like how capitalism is just really built into tarot by design. So it's a very interesting and important viewpoint, I think, that he discussed with me on that episode. In the Hierophant, I wanted to bring up Alice Barkley Catt's quote on page 65. You'll turn to page 65 in your book. So Charlie is quoting Alice Sparkly Cat here. Charlie writes, they write that astrology is not inherently special or magical, but instead that the magic comes from the community that deconstructs, recreates, and makes it their own. Quote, astrology works not because there is anything magical about the language itself, but because the act of not believing readily, or the act of not believing readily, of believing where belief has been earned, of listening waywardly, is magic. Astrology is not magic. The community that recreates it in the contemporary era is. So this, I feel like, is exactly saying what we were just saying earlier, that it's not, it's not the cards themselves that are magical, but the relationship and the reader and the way the reader waywardly and rupturedly, you know, weaves in all the pieces of their life, you know?
Yeah. In the episode that we, which this is an upcoming episode, when I was speaking with Dajé Alo, they were talking about getting low and listening, and, you know, doing that as an act of like formulating what these things mean to you, as opposed to like taking on whatever kind of avatars people are suggesting that you do, because that's the right way to be. Mm. And that is like ultimately the thing that I think is so powerful about systems, I guess, or deconstructing of them, but also getting to define what these things mean to you.
Yeah. Anything else about the Hierophant?
No.
Okay. let's see. The Lovers. I wanted to kind of... So the Lovers is a card that I... It's probably my favorite card. And it's because of the very intense two-year, like, Dark Night of the Soul, Saturn return moment that I went through when I turned 30. And was just like, I have got to address my daddy issues. And like, I've got to like learn what it means to love yourself, because I've read every self-help book possible and everybody keeps saying, love yourself. And I don't know what the heck that means. I feel like I like myself fine. You know, like that's what I can remember thinking this, but like, what does that mean? And that's not even what I want. I want someone else to love me. I don't, you know, like I don't need to love myself, you know, like, and I just feel like, so many people feel that way, you know? And I had to personally, just speaking for myself, like I had to claw my way to understanding what that meant. And it really, to be totally honest, it took the derailing of my professional career. I mean, it took me not being a performer anymore, which I didn't necessarily put it all together until retrospectively, as we were saying, but like I left performing, I moved into a more stable, like 9-to-5 career, which made more space for me to be able to do some like really deep, you know, excavative work on myself. Mm-hmm. And I had to just claw my way to understanding that. And that is, I think, what the experience of change is like. I do not think change is easy. I think change honestly rarely happens. And takes like dedicated effort, you know, to accomplish. And so I'm saying all this because Charlie quotes bell hooks on page 71 of the Lovers chapter, and who says, this commitment to change is chosen. It happens by mutual agreement. True love is unconditional, but to truly flourish, it requires an ongoing commitment to constructive struggle and change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And like, and so when I read that, it made me kind of have a different feeling about the kind of historical tie of like choice that's often talked about with the Lovers card. You know, in the older decks, there was a sense of like a couple kind of choosing who they wanted to be with. I think there's like a man and two women or something, and there's this sense that maybe he's like choosing his partner or something. And I've never really felt a strong like choice thing from that. It kind of felt simplistic, or I just didn't vibe with that. But when I think about it, how I chose to love myself, like how I chose to change, how I chose to change, and the choice that has to be made to make a change, I was like, oh, okay, now I can get on board with the choice, you know, thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because this is kind of like related to the Lovers, but indirectly related to oneself. I had a coworker who was like, you know, they were saying that they really were manifesting their true love, and they were manifesting the man who was like ready for them and had gone through all the hard work, blah, blah, blah. Basically saying like they wanted the perfect person to walk into their life and be ready for them. Like, I don't know. I feel like that's a very hallmark way of looking at a relationship. And they, you know, I said, I've been married for 15 years, and they kind of were like, well, how do you do it? And I said, well, you have to be really, really ready to be like signing up for, I don't know, it's maybe a little bit of a cliche, but yeah, choosing and intentionally participating in love, because this person is not going to be perfectly ready and they haven't like made it, they are going to be many different versions of themselves, and I'm going to be a very different version of myself probably. I mean, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, I've been like five different people since I got married. So,
Yeah.
but in the way of like loving yourself is kind of like giving yourself the grace and the compassion to like reach deep, like you said, like, scraping and working. And it is like, I often say, like, by the skin of my teeth, like I'm here by the skin of my teeth because I chose by some deep seated willpower to be here. It
Yeah.
wasn't because of magic. It wasn't because I found the person that was perfectly matched to me. It was not. It was, in many ways, it was not. So, and I feel like you can apply that to many different places, why it's a major arcana card. But like in the finding of oneself, it is that. It is that,
Yeah. So, you made a note here about the chariot.
Oh yeah, yes. Okay. So this was really interesting. I loved Charlie's chapter on the chariot, but I think because I didn't learn the tarot in a very, like, I guess, book learning way, I think I'm coming around to a lot of these meanings secondhand. And so for me, it's like, it's interesting because what they're saying about the chariot is to kind of, and I wonder how the listeners feel. I feel like the way that we, or at least many people in my experience, view the chariot is similar to how they feel about like the Hierophant in like, following rigid rules because that's the way that we're supposed to do it. And the way that I was taught that the chariot was is more of like a chess player, kind of employing these different pieces and these, you have these aspects of yourself or whatever situation that you're dealing with, and you're kind of like delegating, delegating these different parts according to their strengths, right? So if I'm organizing an event and I say, okay, you're the person that I need to go in and organize like the DJ because you're better and you're more connected that way. That's kind of how I view the chariot very much. And so it's interesting because reading this chapter, I was like, oh, I've never seen it like that. I didn't ever really see that this was a card that is kind of associated with much more of like a general type of way. I don't know why that's coming to me just now in learning the chariot. But it's kind of interesting because Charlie points to like the kind of reverse or the maybe toxic view of the chariot, which is to kind of just go through the motions. Or on the other side of it, right, the upright one would be like, let's see, where was it? Where did I find this? Progress, and how progress for progress's sake is often how we kind of get to like it's a mechanism of capitalism. And I didn't really ever think of it that way. So I thought that was a really interesting, and I would love to hear what, if any listener wants to email into us or comment on our posts, like I would love to hear how you view the chariot. And if it is in this kind of rigid hierarchical way, if you view it in the same vein as the Hierophant, or if you view it differently. Yeah.
Yeah, I love, first of all, I love that you learned in this different way, and I love that you had not encountered these ideas before, because it also goes back to like what we were saying about bringing what you bring, and I'm all about like a non-systematic like learning of
Yeah.
the tarot, so like I love that. And yeah, I got asked to write a piece for the Rebus, and this year the theme is the chariot. And me personally, like my favorite way of understanding the major arcana at this point in my life is to group all the numbers together that link up. So like the chariot is 7 goes with the tower is 16, and to use that relationship to learn about each card from the relationship with each other,
Yeah.
and so like for me the chariot is a lot about formation, like a formational sense of self and like an identity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like and a directionality because of that, like sort of being like, this is who I am, this is the path I'm going to go down because this is who I am.
Yeah.
And then the tower kind of is a teacher card for the chariot in that the tower breaks that, and says, no, this is a facade. This is not real. This is not who you are. Like, how are you going to handle not knowing who you are? How are you going to handle like a sense of wondering or a sense of being sort of lost, which can be a really beneficial moment in one's life, but is really difficult. You know, it's very hard to be lost, you know?
I love that. Yeah. I don't know. I think I remember being really shocked when I found out the chariot was ruled by Cancer. Cause I was like, that does not feel very Cancerian to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Except I will say
strategic card.
Yeah. I mean, Lindsay Mack teaches it in that way. And they sort of explain it as like that shell, you know, that Cancer crab shell, and the way that is sort of the formation, but on the bottom side of that is the soft, like, underbelly. And I do, of the Cancers I know in my life, like, they are very good at nurturing others, but are very afraid sometimes to show their vulnerability. You know, they're really good at making other people feel safe, but they're not so into like showing their underside, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I can kind of see that Cancerian connection, you know?
Okay. There. So then in that case, I guess it makes sense that a general would be the depiction of,
yeah,
at least, you know, on paper, I guess.
Right. But right.
Anyway.
Anything that you wanted to share on strength?
No, I really loved that chapter.
Strength is a hard one for me, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that I've always thought about strength as more of like an allyship card in the, the card that I first had, the very first tarot deck that I had a depiction of the strength figure wrestling the lion. And so to me, to see the Rider-Waite depiction of the, like, the angelic figure, I guess, petting or almost like, yeah, I don't know. It's like they're like, there's a camaraderie, I guess, between the two of them. And so I thought that always equated in my mind as like allyship, which does take a sort of strength because it is kind of a push and pull, a give and take card. But I've said for years and years, I love the idea that wildness is a construct, right? So that, like, to kind of parse away from the idea that like wild is somewhere out there, mm-hmm. and instead kind of integrating the idea that we are wild, allows us to be both, and allows us to be the structure and the trickster spirit that's weeding through the cracks, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love Charlie's, there was a Morton quote, that Charlie, uses on page 84 that really speaks to that. It says, Timothy Morton suggests conceptualizing nature as a mesh, a non-totalizable, open-ended concatenation of interrelations that blur and confound boundaries at practically any level between species, between the living and the non-living, between organism and environment. What a quote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. We've made it to the Hermit. So this is our last chapter that we're reading this month. And I really loved this connection to Kronos, to sort of Saturn. So on page 87, Charlie says, the lantern-bearing philosopher was not the original prototype for the Hermit, however. The earliest decks show the figure of an old man, often leaning on crutches, holding up not a lantern but an hourglass. Mm-hmm. Names for this version included the old man and time, and the card is thought to have represented exactly that, old age and the swift and unstoppable passage of time. The card came to be associated with Saturn, Kronos, god of time and limits. In at least one deck, the 16th century Liber Tarot, the card was named Rerum Edax, or Devourer of Things.
I love that. Ooh, I want that. Let's put that on my epitaph. Like, I'm going to put that on my gravestone. Devourer of Things. Oh, no, but it's so interesting because I think in my mind, Saturn as a planetary figure is always kind of I call it the come to Jesus moment of like, this is a boundary and we need to really assess and kind of, you know, take a second to figure out what's working and what's not working. And that's always been Saturn to me, is planet of like boundaries and check-ins. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me to have this kind of like, Yeah, the Hermit kind of be the one that's asking those questions, but I think it's a much more subtle disruptor of, you know, to kind of withdraw as opposed to be the one shattering things, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting to hold that, you know, this is very common in like Greek mythology and and other mythologies as well, this that one god kind of has many, you know, powers or many like realms or whatever that it's sort of, you know, part of. And the idea that Saturn or Cronus is simultaneously the devourer of things and the boundary is like kind of interesting, you know, like that's very paradoxical, because the devourer of all things is like boundaryless, you know, like
but I
like thinking about it in terms of we have a life, and we have our body, we have our form, and then in Cronus and the Hermit and Saturn we encounter death, which does devour all things, and that relationship with the fact that we are going to die brings our life into hyper reality. That's a teaching of Stephen Batchelor. So that's like a something that Stephen Batchelor teaches in the Faith to Doubt, and in a lot of his teachings, is like pondering death and meditating on death. And this, it's a Buddhist concept too, you know, coming into relationship with death brings life more forward, you know, like, so
brings everything into a focus of like, it's not the dying necessarily that we fear, but what to do with the energy and the time that we have left is of, you know, brings it into a more heightened importance, I guess.
Yeah. And it's so hard. I mean, it's so trippy and scary and truly awe-inspiring, like that this life that we know right now will end, because it just feels so endless. It's like really hard. And we can't wrap our tiny minds around non-life. Like, what is that? You know, like, and that's a very deep, deep thing that I think maybe Saturn can teach us, or can kind of hold us in. I don't know that it can teach us, 'cause I don't know we ever understand that, but it's like a place that we can go to, and a current to draw on David Davis's teachings on astrology as like currents, you know, which I really like the current of Saturn being that like kind of sublime, like terrifying and awe-inspiring non-life, you know.
Yeah, I think he often uses the word necrotic, which I love. He has such a way of words. I love it. But yeah, it is. And it's kind of like there are relationship, and on a, like, if we're wanting to shrink it down on kind of like a microcosm level, the tarot can teach us about like creating a healthy relationship with the things that are dead and dying, and, you know, the systems that are dead and dying, or the things that are outside of our reality that we perceive as dying, you know, things like that, that can teach us or stretch us, right?
Yeah. And then it's interesting with tarot, because the tarot then is going to take us so much further. Like, if the Hermit is kind of this encounter, it's going to then take us so much further down the journey with the majors, you know, which is interesting to think about too. So yeah, this was awesome. Like, so many amazing things. Maybe we can leave listeners with, I had a couple of questions that I came up with, and if you have anything else, but I wanted to offer questions that you can kind of think about as you're reading, that you can journal about, that you can also bring with you if you attend our discussion on the 23rd of this month on Patreon. So the first question that I came up with is, what is your relationship to the word radical, and how does it relate to your tarot practice? What does a radical tarot practice look like to you? And then the next question was, which of these first 10 cards, including the Fool, feels most relatable to you? Which feels least relatable? And how might you go about deepening your relationship with those cards?
Mine, I had the question about the Chariot, about whether folks read the Chariot as being related energetically to the Hierophant. But also, I wanted to ask a question about, I guess, related to the Hermit, about people's relationship with solitary inquiry, their relationship with the things that are dying, whether that is on a, you know, a micro level or on a macro level. And if they have a teacher, what or who that is at this time. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Angie, for dropping down that rabbit hole. I think it was a lot. It was more fruitful than I even expected. That was fantastic.
We always do this, and I'm so looking forward to hearing what everybody says, because we always have a really great conversation with our tarot hangs. So
Yes, I am too. And please do. I mean, you know, like I said, we wanted to make this available to everyone. So, you know, if joining Patreon is not in the cards for you, you know, please engage with us on social, you know, email us, Instagram, DM us, tell us what you're thinking about this book. We really would love to hear. We both are total nerds and love to read and would love to talk to some other nerds out there. So yeah, thank you so much. And maybe we'll see you on the 23rd. And if not, we will see you next week.